ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A while back at the Mayo Clinic, they tested the impact of nature sounds and soft music on heart surgery patients. And by day two post-op, the pain and anxiety levels of the nature sound patients was significantly lower. So, if life is poking you in the heart right now, why not bathe in the sound of nature? It won't cure your ills, but it will make you feel better about them. Nature Sounds by Anne Jones, wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
Coming to you from the lands of the Kulin Nation on ABC Radio National, this is Life Matters. Hello, I'm Beverly Wang. Let's talk about the mental struggle of physical pain and how the brain and body are more linked than you might think. What are your experiences with pain? How has it changed you? And how have you tried to find relief? In a moment, you're going to hear from one of Australia's leading pain researchers who's going to explain a different way of understanding pain. And in 40 minutes' time, the aunties unpack a downsizing dilemma. Let's talk. If you are living with long-term chronic physical pain, or you are close with anyone who does, you know how terribly draining and difficult that experience is. Coping with pain at that level and duration steals our energy, sense of self, our incomes, even our mental health. According to Pain Australia, nearly 3 in 4 people develop mental health conditions after their chronic pain conditions begin. It is a pervasive condition, and the solution can be evasive, sometimes causing you to wonder or even be questioned about whether it's all in your head. So today, let's dig into how pain works and deepen our understanding of its purpose in the hope of helping you find a way through it. I'm doing it with some very qualified help from Professor Lorimer Moseley, AO. He's a neuroscientist and leading pain researcher who was foundation chair in physiotherapy and professor of clinical neurosciences at Adelaide University. Hi, Lorimer. Welcome to Life Matters.
G'day, Beverly. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. Lorimer, let's start with the basics. What is pain?
The basics. Wow.
That's complicated, really, answer, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a really challenging question, but I guess we could take two angles on that question. The first is everyone, almost everyone on Earth knows what pain is because they've felt it. And as you said, it's probably 20% of humans who feel it every day, and a big chunk of those people are disabled by it. But I guess the question that I would find easier to answer is how does it work?
Mm-hmm. Because
we sort of, you know, we all know what our pain is because we feel it, but we don't know what anyone else's is. So my answer to that question as a neuroscientist, so as someone who studies how the brain works and how the brain and the immune system work together and those sorts of things, I think that pain is a feeling that we have in our body that makes us change our behavior to keep our body safe. So you could say that it's a protective feeling. And one of the beautiful and very challenging aspects of pain is that we feel it somewhere in our body. So that makes it different to other experiences like vision and things like that, because we feel it in our body.
Yes. Okay. And the function of pain, you said, is protective. There's this idea sometimes that pain, when we talk about pain, there can be this dismissive notion that is it all in my head or it's all in your head. But I understand, and that is often used, you know, to denigrate or not really understand people. But you actually kind of pick that up, and there is, if we take away the judgmental part of it, there's truth in that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you've touched on the critical challenge that we all face when we're trying to understand how pain works, but we need to let go of the way we used to think pain worked. And to answer your question, it might be easier to start with how we used to think pain worked. And that was really planted by a philosopher 400 years ago called René Descartes. And I used to sing a song about René Descartes. Can I sing you the song?
Yeah, be brave.
It's very,
just
it's
briefly.
Very short,
yeah, okay,
and
go
it does
for
include,
it.
It does include a word that's almost a swear word.
Okay, so, forewarned. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, forewarned. So when we're trying to help health professionals understand how pain works, we have to first undermine this 400-year-old idea from René Descartes. And the song, and I apologise, I'm not a singer.
Is it going
right?
to be painful, Lorimer?
It's going to be painful for us all. But okay. René Descartes was very, very smart, which is why we sing this song. But I must impart, he was a jolly old fart. And as it turns out, he was wrong. And the reason that we have to say that is that René Descartes is the person behind the idea that when you have pain detectors that send a pain message to your brain, that ring a little bell in your brain to say, there's pain in your foot, for example. And hopefully when people hear that, they think, yeah, that's how I think pain works. Mm. But that's not how pain works. It turns out that he was wrong. And we now understand that actually all pain is something that you feel, and it only exists once the brain makes it. So the idea that pain is in your head, I don't think that's right, because pain is in your body, but I do think it's right to say pain is made by your brain. And in this way, actually, pain is no different from all the other experiences that we have. But the challenge is that it's so compelling that it's in your foot or in your back or in your knee or wherever it is, that we experience this illusion that the pain is being generated at that body part. But actually the pain is being generated by your, we say brain, but if there's real technical people who are informed, they'll say, hang on, it's not just your brain, and that's correct. But it's, you know that game, the last one to touch it sort of has to own it, remember that? It's a bit like that. The brain is the last part of a complex puzzle that is ultimately responsible for making the feeling of pain. So
okay,
it's
Laura,
not in your head, but it's made by your head.
Okay, this is interesting and fascinating, and I'm trying to understand like everybody else. If I smash my toe, if I stub it, that hurts really badly. The pain is real.
Yeah.
My brain is creating the pain.
Yeah.
The pain is or is not located in my foot. Does my toe, big toe, actually hurt?
Yes, it does, but only because your brain makes it so, and your brain doesn't always make it so. So if you did stub your toe, but at exactly the same time, a car came screaming around the corner and is about to hit you, your brain would not make toe pain. It would make fear of the car. And you would escape death before your brain made toe pain.
Right. I'm going to.
It's full on, isn't it?
I'm going to ask another question to really understand. I hope this is also helping people listening to you, because I'm struggling, but I want to know. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking now about people with terminal diagnosis. Right. I've lost many family members this way, and if you have been through that, if you have sat with somebody, you know the huge amount of pain that they are experiencing at that point in their life. Yeah. It's really excruciating. There's so many meds to help make them comfortable. Yeah. In instances like that, because I never want to dismiss anybody's pain, that is very much physically present and felt.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All pain is very much physical and felt. All pain, we have this saying that all pain is 100% real, no matter what is contributing to it.
Okay. All right. I'm going to sit with that. It's really, really interesting. While I sit with that and you help us digest this definition, which is, really reframing, let's go to Sean in New South Wales. Sean, welcome to Life Matters. You're a mediator. And you say that's helped you cope with your pain. How so?
I'm a meditator.
A meditator. I'm sorry. I read it wrong.
My pain became unbearable and I couldn't take painkillers. And so when I meditated, I'd take my meditating mind to where the pain is and just politely observe it from a little distance. And it would generally, like an ice cube, it would melt down and it wouldn't turn off. But I had this idea that my resistance was somehow tied up in the whole thing. But it would definitely go down if I just sat quietly and just watched it. Same way you watch a kid playing in a park, or, you know, watch a train go past.
What kind of physical pain were you in, Sean?
I did a major injury to both of my shoulders and lost the use of them for about 3 months.
Mm-hmm. And while you were meditating, were you doing any other treatments?
No.
No, interesting. Lorimer, can you come in here and just talk about what Sean's explained? Have you observed this as well?
Yeah, g'day, Sean. Thanks for that insight. Meditation is an extraordinarily effective way to have some control over what your brain and nervous system are doing. Most people need to learn how to do it and practice for a long time to be good at it. But what Sean's described there, and it's a beautiful description, Sean, of comparing it to like you watch someone in a playground, and that ability to observe the body parts. So, in Sean, your case, in your shoulders, to observe that pain without responding to it is intervening in what I mentioned earlier. The idea of pain is to make us change our behaviour. But what Sean's been able to do there is observe the feeling and not change the behaviour. And by doing that, his system starts to learn that maybe this feeling is not necessary for your longevity, for survival in the moment. And when that happens, the way I would understand what Sean's described, and there are a lot of people who have experiences like this, there are whole treatments, mindfulness components of acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, focus on observing but not responding and not acting. And the way I would make sense of that is that our inner organism, our system, is learning in the moment, okay, this feeling that's being created may not be the best feeling for me in this moment, and therefore it starts to reduce. And I would predict that if Sean could spend decades learning, he would develop such an acute skill here that he could turn the pain completely off through meditation.
Wow, that is really interesting to hear. Sean, thank you so much for kicking us off with your story. And it's good that you've been able to use meditation to such an effective result. Let's go to Alistair in WA. Welcome to Life Matters, Alistair. You had an accident 7 years ago, and what's your strategy for coping with pain?
Yeah, good morning. It's about distraction, and I have tried, and I meditate as well. However, distraction, keeping busy, that's a bit of a problem, so, because your mind's then always on the go, and it's like you can never relax. So it's great to hear that meditation can work. From my experience, so in the short term, and the intensity of things, you could say, when things are really intense,
yeah,
things just became completely overwhelming for me, completely overwhelming. A bird on my shoulder was what the voice in my head was telling me, a bird with claws on my shoulder. Mm-hmm.
That's awful. Yeah. And that would have taken a mental toll as well for you, not just the physical pain?
Yeah, and I speak openly about it. It did contribute to suicidal action within about, 6 months of the injury, feeling that it was a compounding. You know, I've learned so much in the time since. There was other aspects going on biopsychosocially, but that injury was certainly, to me, the no pun intended, the straw that broke the camel's back and ended with an attempt in hospitalization.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I'm so sorry, but I'm glad that you are here today to share your story. What is your level of pain now?
Yeah, it sits, and I was just at my OT last week with an assessment where hopefully we're going to finally find what's going on. It sits chronically about a 7, but it does get higher as the day progresses. It also depends on certain activities. And it's just, you know, the metaphor there I say to people is, people say, yeah, it's in your head, just get over it. Mm-hmm. I say, well, if you were to walk around all day with a small piece of Lego in your shoe, you need to get rid of that piece of Lego. That is like the worst pain ever, walking on a piece of Lego. So
before I let you go, Alistair, I want to know if you've been listening in and you heard Lorimer's explanation of how pain works. How does that resonate with you?
Yeah, it did. And it's funny because my surgeon said to me, I said, so you're telling me that it's not just in my head? And he said, well, it is in your head, but it's not. It's in your head in terms of the connection, but you're not making this up. And it was so heartening. And to be honest with you, to round off, it gives me hope. Yeah. It gives me hope.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you so much, Alistair. And thank you for listening and calling in from WA. We don't often get callers from WA, so it's really nice to hear from you. You must be up early. Appreciate you listening. Lorimer Moseley, I want to come to you. We've heard two really interesting callers talking about that mind connection. But I do want to ask about the role of medication and painkillers. We live in a world where, you know, medication pills, they're very easy to access and a lot of people use them. What about those treatments and how does that fit into this model of pain that you've explained to us?
Yeah, great story from Alistair. And there's from Alistair and Sean already, there's so much wisdom in the radio room there. Mm-hmm. And I imagine there's people all over the place listen to this who have got insights that everyone else would benefit from. Medication, I need to make it really clear that I am not a prescriber, so I'm not a medical doctor and I'm not a pharmacist. I do have an understanding of the evidence around these things and the biology of how these things work. So my answer to your question is that pain is extraordinarily complex from a biology perspective, and it's also extraordinarily individual. It is as individual as we are, because when it comes to pain, everything matters. So that means that there will be some people in pain for whom there are molecules, so that's how we talk about medications, there are molecules that they can ingest or have injected that change their pain levels. And on average, for acute pain, so that's pain associated with an injury, a clear injury. If you twist your ankle and you have ankle pain that slowly resolves over weeks, or if you have surgery, those sorts of things, there are molecules or medicines that can reduce that pain in the short term. The most famous of those medicines are the opioids. So they're the morphines and things like that. The problem with those medications is that those molecules go everywhere and they have receptors in your body all over the place. So that's why they're associated with side effects and they're associated with risks. When we look at the evidence for long-term pain, so people with chronic pain, on average, there are no medications that offer, on average, benefit over the long term. Now, there are some people who get benefit and there are some people for whom things get worse. So the average turns out to be the middle. So along with an informed medical advisor, an informed GP or a pain specialist, some people with chronic pain do get some help from some medications. The challenge is that sooner or later on most of those medications, the assistance that they give will start to fade. Mm. And the problem there is that their system is used to having it. And then we hit problems like tolerance, an addiction, and working out what else can I do to fill the gap that is left by reducing my drugs. And a lot of the work that we do is focused on that. How can you reduce your medications and learn other skills and train yourself in those skills to get the analgesia, the pain relief, that your medications might have been giving you, but they had intolerable side effects. So the easiest answer to your question, Beverly, is it all depends.
Yeah.
But on average, for chronic pain, there are no medications that on average are all that helpful.
This is ABC Radio National Life Matters with me, Beverly Wang, and that is Professor Lorimer Moseley. While we're talking about the experience of chronic pain, someone who has experienced acute pain and chronic pain is Lauren Richards, who does peer support and community education about her lived experience of chronic pain. Lauren, welcome to Life Matters. In 2013, you were living a very active lifestyle, and then one day you went to the gym. Something happened. Take us back there.
Yeah, so I was undertaking a fairly intense class at the gym and experienced a brain hemorrhage, which was obviously quite unexpected and involved a fairly long and painful recovery. But unfortunately, around 18 months after that, after I'd moved through that recovery, I was hit by a vehicle while I was cycling.
Goodness.
So I again had quite a long and painful recovery period.
Yes. And how did that ongoing pain affect you? What kind of relief did you seek and how effective was that?
Initially, I thought I was recovering okay. But what I found was as I tried to get back to physical activity after the accident, every injury I sustained was sort of disproportionately painful. I was experiencing a lot more pain and for a lot longer periods of time than would be normally expected for the types of injuries I had. And eventually I just got to the point where I was always in pain. The pain didn't go away and it would actually start moving around my body. So I started feeling pain in areas that hadn't been injured through those two experiences.
That must have been felt really debilitating for you, not just physically but also mentally.
Yes, it was debilitating, but it was also really scary because I couldn't understand why I was in so much pain. And I kept trying to seek answers for the pain, and I couldn't find any answers.
Eventually, what did you end up doing? What helped you?
Well, this period of time where I was in pain went on for several years, so there was a lot of things that I tried, but ultimately I visited with an exercise physiologist who was the first person to really bring to my attention that my pain might be something else than a physical injury, because I kept looking for some sort of diagnosis of where the injury was. And he was the first person that said to me that he thought that there was a psychological element to what I was going through. And that's when he pointed me towards Professor Mosley and a TED talk that Professor Mosley did some years ago now. And that was the start of me understanding that there was sort of a lot more going on than just overcoming the injuries I'd experienced.
So what did you have to do? What was that other stuff going on, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, in my case, there was a lot of fear around being in pain because pain was had such a big impact on my life because I was such an active person that any sort of pain brought me a lot of anxiety and fear. And what I know now is that those that anxiety and that fear and that sense of tension can actually amplify and continue the pain that you're in long after your injuries have healed. And so my body was becoming hypersensitive to pain and it really just became the primary focus in my life, and my world kind of revolved around how much pain I was in each day.
So I want to come to Lorimer for a comment as well, but just to round out your story there, Lauren, how did you recover from this? How did you begin to fix and heal and not feel that pain anymore?
Well, the most important aspect was understanding why I was in pain. So through Lorimer and his TED talk and then getting involved with the Pain Revolution, which is an initiative out of the University of South Australia, I learned a lot about how pain works and just demystifying that was quite empowering because I understood then that my body wasn't broken, that my body had become hypersensitized, and there were things that I could do to help bring that sensitivity down. And, you know, they're not necessarily medical things, but it's about understanding that you're safe and taking the fear and anxiety out of what you do each day, getting back to movement again. You know, a gradual introduction back into moving every day and an integration back into work and social life, and sort of understanding the psychological aspects of my experience that led me to that point so that I could self-manage them again.
That's so interesting, Lauren. Thank you for sharing. Lorimer, the calls, you wouldn't believe it, are backed up. So I do want to come to you for a comment, but then we got to quickly move on to fit everybody in. What Lauren's saying is so interesting. And, you know, she had long-term physical pain. It makes me wonder if you can help me understand this. You know, the extent of the understanding of pain that you have described and that Lauren has backed up with her experience, how widely understood is that across the medical field and the allied health field generally? Because it seems like it's a very common experience to seek help, to be trying to do all the right things like Lauren has, and just it doesn't work. So clearly there are some practitioners who do understand, like that exercise physiologist that helped Lauren turn things around, but there are also many who don't. So what is the extent of understanding pain the way your research and the way you have described it? And how can practitioners learn more? Like, what's the state of education there?
Wow. Like, how many days do we have for this conversation?
You got about 90 seconds, Lorimer, for this one.
Oh, well, let me start by saying, you know, the insights of people like Lauren, like there's so much in what Lauren just said that is gold, and I would recommend anyone who is challenged by chronic pain finds a way to keep listening to what Lauren has talked about, and she's got a great TED Talk that I've seen. It's just fantastic. And to answer your question, I would the easiest way for me to answer that is, this is much better known than it was 20 years ago, and it's nowhere near widely enough known still, which is why there are groups like mine, but like others, who are working very hard with health professionals to help them get their head around this. I mean, the evidence is extraordinarily strong. The most effective component of care for people with chronic pain, no matter what the diagnosis, is education. There's over 100 clinical trials. It's locked in guidelines all over the world. It's the cornerstone of care. But the challenge that we face is that most health professionals have trained and have worked, and when I say health professionals, doctors, physios, OTs, psychs, nurses, exercise physiologists, we trained and we have practiced in a model of the body where there is a single cause and effect. And our treatments are based on that, and our way of thinking has been based on that. And now we're in a situation where the most disabling health problem on earth, chronic pain, by a long way, doesn't obey those rules. It's a complex, multifactorial, individual thing that is mediated, that is caused by what Lauren has talked about, pain system hypersensitivity. So we need health professionals to understand that, but also to embrace the reality that education is very helpful and very difficult to do well. So we all have to get better at it. Now, I've skirted your question because I don't know what proportion of health professionals. I just know not enough, but more than there was. And understanding this and being able to engage in this as a health professional changes our lives as well. Burnout is really high in people working with patients with chronic challenges, including chronic pain. And when we get our head around the challenge, like it's truly challenging when you have chronic pain to recover. It's very challenging, and you need to retrain a system that is working hard to protect you. But when health professionals can get the skills of enabling people with understanding, empowering them with skills and almost like coaching programs, our lives as health professionals become better as well, because we see these extraordinary transformations like Lauren's, and there will be thousands of people listening to this who are in a situation like Lauren's or who have been in one and have found their way out. And a lot of our research asks those people, how did you do it? People like Lauren, how did you do it? What was the most important thing you learned and did? And now we are trying to tell as many people as possible about those things.
Quick couple of questions on the text line. A texter says, what about migraine pain? Mine comes up in the middle of the night and wakes me up. Unbearable pain that I couldn't have manufactured because I was asleep. How does that work?
I don't know.
Okay.
Is the easiest answer to that question, but I'd love to draw on the last bit, which implies that because you're asleep, it can't be manufactured. I disagree with that part because the brain is always working and we have feelings no matter what state of consciousness we are in. But I completely validate and endorse the first part, and that is this is confusing, this is disabling, and in my view, migraine remains a real challenge to understand. And there are people working hard on that, and there are some types of migraines that obey the same principles of other chronic pain disorders. And we have people with migraines in our trials who some of them respond exactly the same as the low back pains, the complex regional pain syndrome, fibromyalgia, endometriosis. But there is a group of migraines that seems to have a different mechanism underneath it that are really challenging. And we've still got a long way to go to offer the same hope and benefit that we're currently offering other types of chronic pain.
Okay, and one more text before we hit the phone lines again. This texter says, this is their words, this is the dumbest question, but is some mental illness a type of chronic pain, a chronic emotional pain? And then they say, this is a reframing that has stopped me judging myself so much sometimes.
Yeah, well, my first response is, I don't think there's any dumb questions, right?
Correct.
If we all asked all our questions, we'd all make a lot more progress because there's a lot of wisdom in the questions that people ask. And I would say that for this question, that's actually a really insightful question and is on the edge of the conversations that a range of researchers, philosophers, physiologists, psychologists, and medical people are asking. What are the similarities and differences between the pain you feel in your body and that anguish and grief that you might feel when you lose a loved one or when unrequited love or fatigue that we can't get on top of or anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder or loneliness? And when we look at these conditions biologically, they have a lot in common. They have a lot of similar, we call them biomarkers. So that's biological markers of the condition. So it's a really insightful question. Again, my answers to most questions are either it depends or I don't know. But I love the way this person is thinking because there is so much that is shared across all of what I would describe as our feeling states or our protective states.
Okay, let's take another call. Wendy is in the ACT. Wendy, welcome to Life Matters. You had to work through an intense pain experience 40 years ago. What did you do?
Hi, Beverly. Hi, Lorimer.
Hi, Wendy.
So what I had a medical kind of like an issue, and then I had to have a surgical procedure every day for about 7 days, which was incredibly painful. So they gave me pethidine, and I had that for, and I was like an outpatient, I had that for, I can't remember the exact number of days, probably 5 or 6 days. And then they, on the seventh day, for example, they said you can't have it and because you can become addicted. And I was so upset. I started crying and said, I won't be able to handle the pain if I don't have the, you know, I've got to have it. And they said, sorry, you can't. So I just sort of, you know, took a breath and thought, okay, they're not going to give it to me. So, and I just, something switched in my head. And the weird thing was I was back in that sort of exact same feeling as though I was on the drug, but without side effects. And I was able to, which is what the drug did for me, divorce the pain that I was feeling. It was like, you know, I was in my head, I you know, could feel it happening, but it didn't matter. It was in, it was sort of divorced from me in my arm. So it was a really, and I had to go back subsequent days and I was able to switch back into the same thing. But yeah, so it worked for that period in my life. I've since, you know, I've got chronic pain now from whiplash, but I haven't been able to get back to that sort of feeling.
So that mindfulness worked for that incident.
Yeah, it was so weird. It was so strong. Like I so strongly felt.
But for your whiplash that you have pain from now, mindfulness has not helped.
No. Well, I haven't really worked at it hard enough. So I feel quite inspired by hearing Lauren and your first caller about meditation as well. But it was just so strong with the when I was in my 20s that with the pethidine, and then I didn't have it, and how I was able to, it was like I was on the drug and I didn't have it. So I could switch back into that feeling of not minding the pain.
Thank you for, Wendy, thank you for sharing. Lorimer, quickly before we go to our next caller, the contrast in the two examples Wendy has given us, in one case she was able to use mindfulness, in the current pain that she does experience, she says it has not been as effective. So what can we say here? Obviously on a radio, we can't endorse like don't use drugs or anything like that. Like that's not our place to do that. But it's an interesting contrast. What are your thoughts on that contrast?
Oh, my first thought is how cool are these stories? And these types of stories are all over the place in the pain field, because wild things happen. And wild things can happen not just in the same person, like Wendy has described, but they can happen in the same person at exactly the same time and moment. And what it strikes me every time I hear these stories, I just think how fearfully and wonderfully complex we are. We are extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And that extraordinariness applies to our ability to protect ourselves, but it also applies to our ability to change over time and retrain our system. So I think it's right, Wendy, for you to have hope out of the stories of Lauren and Sean, but it's also right that you'll have to work at it because you have to retrain your system. But maybe the key amazing thing of the experience you had, Wendy, in your 20s is to get a handle on that is just to remind ourselves that pain is only ever being produced because the organism that we are, that we have no control over, just the back end of the organism, is trying to protect us. And in her scenario of the team saying, you cannot have pethidine, then that's a new piece of information and reality that the brain considers when it's deciding what will be the benefit or not of pain here. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing stuff.
They're really fascinating stories. Sue in Sydney, welcome to Life Matters. You had a massage that really helped you get through some severe pain.
It was a back specialist physiotherapist who saw me, and she massaged because it was basically a spasm in my back that really actually was a compressed disc. So pretty much it was sciatica that I was experiencing. And she explained to me what was going on, which was really, I think it was relieving the fear of my pain that I thought, oh, you know, I'm going to be crippled. I'm going to be, you know, I'm not going to be able to move on all this sort of thing. That she sort of explained it in a way, then I lost the fear.
Sue, was the explanation or was the physical massage?
Because I was in acute pain at the time, the massage helped, but she wasn't just a general massage. She's a back specialist physiotherapist. I think that's really important to know. Yeah. And she gave me then exercises to maintain strength in the muscles that I'd sort of, you know, I'd stop using, because when you have acute pain like that, you stop moving because you're out of fear. Mm. So Am I sorry? Is that bell going off?
No, you're not. You're
no?
Good.
Okay. So yes, I think it was a combination in the acute situation for the massage. Then it was the strategies of the exercises that were strengthening to maintain the strength around that joint, and the losing the fear, because then I can do something about it without medication.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that, Sue. Lorem, I want to come back to you. We're unfortunately wrapping this great conversation soon, but I want to think about listeners right now who are experiencing pain and now listening to you might be inspired to actually go and do something about it. What are the first steps that people can do to try to start on this journey of figuring out pain under the model, the research-backed model that you describe? How do they find the practitioners? How do they find their team? What do they do?
Yeah, great question. And it depends. And it depends on so many things. But I guess the universal first step that the evidence tells us is the cornerstone is learn. Learn this new understanding of pain. And the way to do that is to look for reputable sources for that. So Lauren mentioned before Pain Revolution. That's a non-profit that was set up 7 or 9 years ago now, and there's resources on that website. So just put into your search engine Pain Revolution. In WA, the WA Health has a great website to learn about pain. In New South Wales, the New South Wales Agency for Clinical Innovation. But Pain Revolution will also take you to those places. So I would say start there. When you see your GP or your health professional, just ask them, do you know about Pain Revolution? What can you tell me about explaining pain? These are the sorts of questions that you'll quickly get a handle on whether this person in front of you has a modern understanding of pain or not. And then look for ways that you can learn how to understand and do things differently. We now talk about the three components of recovery and resilience in chronic pain being learn, do, and connect.
Thank you.
First thing, learn. Do things that are evidence-based. That's important. And connect in with your people, with your places, and with your purpose.
And Lauren, I want to come to you for one final thought. You have lived through this. You are a peer supporter for people who experience chronic pain. What words would you like to leave with anybody listening today who is going through that right now?
What I would say is that I can remember in the depths of my experience feeling like I would never not be in pain, and that was my life now. And that can be a really dark place, but you can recover, and I'm an example of that. And recovery is not always a straight line, but it's certainly possible. There's definitely hope.
Thank you so much. Professor Lorimer Moseley is the Foundation Chair in Physiotherapy and a Professor of Clinical Neuroscience at Adelaide University. That website that he mentioned once more is called Pain Revolution. Lauren Richards is a police officer who does peer support and community education about her lived experience of chronic pain. We will put a link to her TEDx talk, A New Way to Think About Pain, in the notes for this audio segment online. And as Lorimer said, have that conversation with your health practitioner as a first step. Up next, the aunties await.
Flowers don't usually inspire fierce competition.
Unless you're asking Australians to pick their favourites.
Vote now in the search for Australia's favourite wildflower.
Then join us live as we count down the nation's top blooms, August 21st at noon.
From orchids that look like ducks to fluffy purple desert flowers.
Aww. Vote now at abc.net.au/wildflowers and celebrate Science Week with ABC Radio National.
When you're downsizing and the kids treat your truckload of treasure belongings like trash, how dare they? It's definitely time to ask Auntie. And welcome to your aunties, comedian and proud Butchula Mununjali and Wapabura woman Jaunty Blair, and comedian and actor Lawrence Leung. I'm going to get straight to it because we're a bit pressed for time, gang. Lawrence, how do you and your family go when it comes to hoarding, otherwise known as keeping many sentimental objects?
Oh, it's really tricky. I mean, you have to decide what is meaningful to each person, you know. But also, I'm a bit of a hoarder myself. I've got like tons of CDs from my formative youth. I don't think I even have a CD player anymore.
Oh, well, you should go get one and add to your collection of things, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Get onto Marketplace. Jonty, how about you? Are you and your family the kind of people who like to hang on to stuff?
I hang on to stuff probably more than anyone in the family. I had parents, we were in, the dad was in the army for 23 years, so we moved every 12 months. And so when we packed up to leave, we'd get rid of stuff. So mum and dad were pretty good at doing that.
Yep. Traveling light. Very good. Okay. I love to hear your perspectives. Let's get to today's letter writer, Lorraine. Lorraine says, in a few months, my husband and I will be downsizing from our long-term family home in the suburbs into an apartment. The job of sorting through all of our stuff has been huge. It's also been very heartening. The more boxes I've been going through, the more sentimental gems I've been finding. Stuff from the kids' years growing up, from our early years as a couple, our own childhoods, and even our parents' childhoods. Jonty, this is generational stuff. Can you relate? What do you think of Lorraine's situation so far?
Yeah, I can relate in generational stuff, you know. Things become sentimental, especially old black and white photos. Like I've just noticed with my mum and dad, I love the black and white photos they keep in the cabinets, but you can go into their bedrooms and find, you know, dad's got about 10 suits that I don't think he wears. You know what I mean? Mum's got about six pajama sets that she doesn't wear, you know?
Sometimes the longer you keep something, I have this fear. It's like if you keep it, it's going to be accrue sentimental value. So just get rid of it before it stays there for too long. I'm kind of haunted by that. Lawrence, what do you think about Lorraine's situation? She's got at least three generations of things that she's hanging on to.
I mean, three generations is a lot. It's going to take some explaining to her kids what some of these things are. It's important for the idea of, you know, sentimentality. You have to explain the family history so that people understand where you're coming from.
Okay, now quickly from both of you before we move to part two. Lawrence, what's your policy when it comes to keeping and chucking? Like, do you lovingly go through every item or do you just, you have to be heartless and just chuck it out without dwelling on it?
I'm not really the person to ask. I really keep on to things. I keep things for far too long. I still have VHS tapes. I've got.
Have you got a VHS player?
Yeah, I do. Okay. I don't know if it works. I haven't played the VHS tapes on it for a very long time. But I understand the situation. Yeah. It's very difficult to sort through.
What about you, Jonty? Are you a sentimental keeper or are you a heartless chucker?
It depends on what it is. Hmm. But look, I'm an Aboriginal woman. So lots of Aboriginal people didn't have loads of generational wealth or heirlooms, but we had things that might have been made back in the day. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that Dad's got several. I know this sounds going to sound funny, but he's got several boomerangs. He's not going to throw those boomerangs out if they were given to him by his, you know, his dad who made them, who carved them out of wood. You know,
well, those things sound very like special.
They sound very special, yeah. But you know, we—I guess we don't have generational things. But I feel that I don't chuck things out as best I can. Or if I chuck them out and I leave them at a friend's place, 12 months later they're still there asking me when I'm going to collect my belongings.
Okay, so let's continue. Lorraine has optimistic plans. Here they are. In our new place, there's a small storage unit, but both of our adult children have very large family homes with garages and lots of wardrobes. I assume they'd be happy to become the proud inheritors of these special objects. But when I showed them both the 10 boxes I'd neatly packed for them to divvy up and take care of, it didn't go well with things like, you can't be serious, Mom, and that's completely ridiculous, I think were a couple of things that they said. And both of them accused me of being a hoarder and wanting to load them up with my old crap. Okay, that's quite a reaction, Lawrence. What do you think of these adult children's reactions?
Well, I've been in a similar situation where my parents downsized and they trucked over heaps of boxes, and including two filing cabinets to my place. The only difference was they were my stuff. They were crap that I had left, you know, from growing up at their place for decades. And I don't know why they wouldn't want to keep a half-torn Pulp Fiction movie poster, but you know, it turns out I was the hoarder in the situation.
Right. Okay. The mirror was held up to your face. Jonty, 10 boxes of stuff. What do you think of that amount?
I actually think that's pretty good. Some people have 30, 40, 50 boxes. I think 10's really good. But I think the thing in this situation is I would want them to be clear tubs, you know, the ones from that you get from Bunnings or you get from Officeworks. I want to be able to see what's in them. And I think just packing them up, But the response from the children is extremely harsh. I'm 62. My dad's 85. I would never speak to my parents in such a harsh manner. I come from a different generation. I would never say it's crap or anything. You know, I don't like the response from the children. And I think, you know, you better be careful because, you know, they're the ones writing the will and they're going to be deciding where you come in the chain. You know what I mean?
Let's do the final chapter from Lorraine. Lorraine says, I always try to pause and consider if I've thought enough about my kids' point of views, but this has left me shocked and upset. Firstly, because I'm not sure what I'm going to do with these items now. And secondly, because their lack of understanding about how significant, this is not random stuff to me. Is there a way to explain that this crap is our family's history, its future, and my legacy without completely falling apart? Is it reasonable to be asking them to take it in? Okay, final minutes now. So, Jonty, I'm going to come to you. What is your solution for Lorraine?
To sit down with the children, you know, break open a bottle of champagne, say, you know, look, I've only been given 12 months to live and I've got these boxes here and we need to go through them and I'm doing up my will, you know, with your solicitor this week, and so your response in the next few minutes is very, very important.
Okay, so just turn the screws.
Yes.
Okay. I suppose that's parental prerogative, the emotional manipulation.
They will. And you know what? Just be kind to your parents because you never know. There could be a Buzz Lightyear in those boxes that's worth $1,500 today. Hello, you know, Pokemon cards.
It's true. Yeah. There could be something that's really special.
That's what I think about my half-torn Pulp Fiction
poster.
Yeah,
vintage, right? Okay, Lawrence, what's your final nugget of wisdom? How should Lorraine approach solving this situation with her children?
Yeah, exactly the same way. Just sit down, talk to them over, you know, a glass of wine or two and explain what, you know, what is the significance of each thing. And maybe instead of 10 boxes, limit it to 5 and everyone decides together which pieces they want to keep and which they should throw away.
Yeah, I mean, there might be something really special in them. If you tell the story, it's about communication, right? So if you tell the story of these items and, you know, put some marketing on that, you know, tell the story, you might be able to get a few of those boxes into the cupboards in the garage, Lorraine. You never know. I want to thank our aunties so much today, comedian Jonty Blair and comedian actor Lawrence Leong. If you have a niggling social dilemma that needs our help, having the aunties talk about it can not just be very cathartic, but also extremely helpful. So please write up your problem and email it to lifematters@abc.net.au. We'll get the aunties on the case. That email address again is lifematters@abc.net.au. A huge thank you to Life Matters producers who bring you all the stories and interviews you hear across the entire week. They are Jack McDonald, Bronwyn O'Shea, Lucy Sweeney, Beck Zajac, and our acting executive producer, Grace Hashley. Our audio engineer is Elise Simons, and ABC Listen is your destination to catch up on all Life Matters episodes and stories, especially the conversation on pain that I had with Laura Mosley and Lauren Richards is really worth catching up on. All you have to do is search for Life Matters, tap the heart to follow. You'll be all set. I'm Beverly Wang. Thank you so much for all of your calls and messages. Let's talk again next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.